A housefly and a red eye caught the attention of social media, but what mattered to Texas voters in last night's vice presidential debate? A closer look today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. At least you could hear the candidates actually speak, but in a nation so politically polarized, did anything said in the vice presidential debate have the potential to affect the outcome? Also, Governor Abbott set to reopen more of Texas as COVID cases stabilize, and one of the largest stock exchanges in the world moving from the Big Apple to the Big D? Well, to be fair, it's only part of NASDAQ in talks with Texas, but it could be part of a seismic shift in high finance. Those stories and a whole lot more when the National News Show of Texas gets underway, and that happens right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 8th day of October 2020. I'm David Brown. Big news in Texas as Governor Greg Abbott continues to reopen the state. More on that a bit later in the broadcast. But we begin today's program with an event of national significance as Texans prepare to cast their first in-person ballots in just, what is it now, 5 days. And if there's such a thing as a truly undecided voter in the Lone Star State, the obvious question on this Thursday is whether last night's vice presidential debate did anything to move the needle. One thing the event did have going for it, you could actually hear the candidates talk about real issues, as opposed to last week's so-called presidential debate, which has been universally panned as something more akin to a noisy train wreck. By the way, in case you haven't heard, President Trump announced this morning he will not be participating in a second presidential debate. Although a guest appearance by a housefly and blood vessels in Mr. Pence's left eye seemed to captivate social media during last night's debate, one must ask the morning after, what really mattered? Watching it all was Richard Panetta. He is director of the Sam Donaldson Center for Communication Studies at the University of Texas at El Paso. Professor, welcome back to The Standard.
Great to be here with you, David.
You know, something that you and I were talking about a little bit before we started today's program, we were always, I believe, as the New York Times puts it, just a presidential tweet away from this event getting overtaken in the news cycle. And already, news today, this morning, that President Trump is backing out of the next presidential debate. You got to say that's sort of eclipsing what we're about to talk about.
Yeah, I think that's right, David. It's probably a great explanation for how the debate went last night. Folks were hoping for a popcorn debate, but we got an oatmeal debate, what we expected and probably what we needed.
Well, that's, I like the visual there, the oatmeal debate. Although there were quite a few zingers back and forth, and maybe we, if we have time, we can focus on that. But do you think that in general, vice presidential debates are the sort of things that can actually make a difference in a presidential election cycle, particularly one like we're experiencing currently?
The short answer is not really. In the past, there have been a number of moments when the vice presidential debates were crucial to the overall ticket or to an explanation to the public. I think Vice President Pence had to do that last night. He had to reassure Republican voters that the administration wasn't entirely collapsing. But I think Senator Harris, on the other hand, had a much easier bill to fill, which was to essentially project Biden's strength as a presidential candidate. So I do think they met what they needed to do. I don't think that there's going to be a major shift. I don't think that voters are going to be changing position because of last night's debate.
Let's move from style to substance a bit more, because one of the things that I took note of was how much both candidates focused on fracking at one point in the debate. Obviously, this is an issue that's important to Texas. Kamala Harris has in the past supported the Green New Deal, but she was emphatic about saying the Democratic presidential ticket does not support a ban on fracking. What was she trying to do there? And in fact, did that in some sense cost her among Democrats?
I think it's going to be something that folks that are on the further left side of the Democratic House today will probably not be happy with. I think they're going to see that as conceding to not only the economy of oil, but also the presence of that as a special interest. I think one thing that is interesting, David, is that the Green New Deal has been taken on, I think, by the Republicans as kind of a rhetorical boogeyman. So in a certain way, I'm not even sure that anybody knows what's in the Green New Deal from day one as to whatever is being discussed as a presidential platform. But it certainly is a dog whistle that gets folks irritated, especially on the conservative side, and especially folks that follow issues like oil. So I think in some ways, it's a masterful way to complicate the issue. But I do believe Senator Harris didn't do the best in answering that particular question.
When it comes to substance, it's worth noting what was not discussed. I didn't hear anything on immigration, did you?
I didn't, and that's really surprising, especially given the fact that with states like Texas and California, the border states, immigration is obviously still a major issue. I think the pandemic has moved it back a little bit, but especially given that the Biden campaign is willing to sink, I think, $5 million in an ad campaign that started this week in Texas, that's an issue that I think still has salience. So the fact that neither candidate found a way to bring that into the debate was really surprising.
What do you make of the fact that, as I mentioned, a red eye and a housefly seem to get a lot of attention on social media? Why did those things matter? A housefly landed on Vice President Pence's hair and sat there for a while, I guess.
Well, my guess is we're going to see this on Saturday Night Live in some form or fashion. But, David, I think the thing that's a little bit complicated about that is that when the national zeitgeist is tuned more to those kinds of issues after a debate, it's either indicative of people not necessarily being vested in the substance of the process or being so overwhelmed and tired at this point by the political process. And I think that takes us full circle. I think these debates have changed so much and their impact has been minimized so much that, maybe that's people's best takeaway, that what they're going to remember after last night's debate was the fly more so than anybody's position on fracking or anybody's position on international relations.
Richard Panetta is director of the Sam Donaldson Center for Communication Studies at the University of Texas at El Paso. Professor, thanks again for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
The Big Apple has long been considered the financial capital of the U.S., some might say the world. So when we read in the Dallas Morning News that NASDAQ was in talks with the Texas governor over a possible move to the Big D, well, it certainly caught our attention and likely many on Wall Street and beyond. Dom DeFurio is the Dallas News reporter who broke this story. Dom, welcome to the Texas Standard.
David, thanks for having me this morning.
The headlines started to make waves across the internet, and I understand the governor sat up and took notice, too, apparently responding to your reporting, no?
He did. He confirmed that there were discussions, at least between NASDAQ and his office. You know, he did elaborate a bit on some of what he shared with them. He said he shared that he touted that Texas, can really offer really lax taxation and regulation for data centers like NASDAQ and other exchanges if they're looking to relocate. So
interesting. Very interesting. So I guess if NASDAQ were to move to the Big D or Dallas, that would put a new spin on bull market, I suppose. But let's step back for just a moment, because we're not necessarily talking about moving the entire NASDAQ to Texas, right? We're talking about part of its operations.
Correct. So to understand sort of the pieces that would be at play here, you really have to kind of understand that stock exchanges, including the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ, which both, combined list something like 180 companies based in Texas, they base their data centers where the actual digital trading occurs, those trading platforms, in data centers in New Jersey, just outside of New York. And so those data centers being physically located there subjects them to this tax proposal that's come up and been supported by their governor, Phil Murphy, up there, a Democrat, who has been looking to recoup a budget deficit of a couple billion by placing what's called a financial transaction tax on these institutions. Mm-hmm. And what that would mean is essentially a quarter of a cent tax on every financial transaction that went through at a certain scale. And if you actually crunch the numbers, I mean, it's sizable. I mean, you look at the pure trading volume in the New York Stock Exchange on a daily basis, and you're talking about perhaps hundreds of millions a day being taxed.
So is Texas being used in a way in a political battle that's happening in New Jersey? Is that effectively what's happening here? Or is it serious that that the Lone Star State might actually get to bring in technical division, if you will?
It can be both things. It is both a political leveraging point for the stock exchanges and the financial institutions and firms up on Wall Street in order to sort of beat back this legislation that they are publicly opposed to and have been for some time. But at the same time, we've seen other companies, for instance, I'll just throw Tesla out there, that, you know, in talks about avoiding regulation in states like California, have tossed out the idea of, you know, perhaps moving some pieces of their operations to Texas. And there are times when we see them actually, you know, follow through with that. I think having the governor involved in the discussions lends some credibility to how far along this process is. Mm-hmm. It still sounds preliminary, but we have to watch this because, and it's good to note that there are other states that are also in talks with NASDAQ and the stock exchanges about this move as well.
If Texas landed NASDAQ, even in part, how big of a deal would you see this?
It would be a big deal. I think it would solidify the North Texas region as a really big player in financial services. And of course, we're talking very hypothetically about pretty preliminary discussions. But, you know, the other thing to keep in mind is that these data centers that the transactions are hosted on, I mean, they employ, from my talks with sources, probably hundreds of folks just tending to those data centers. And that's not including the security that it would require, which these things require intensive security. So it would be a sizable addition, I think, to the North Texas economy. And the other thing is, there could be a trickle-down effect of banks and other firms having to follow.
Dom DeFurio is a reporter for the Dallas Morning News who broke this story that Texas officials have been in talks with NASDAQ about moving part of their operations to the Lone Star State. Dom, thanks so much for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much for having me, David.
Wells Dunbar monitoring what the talk of Texas is on this Thursday. I have a hunch I know what it is. Debate,
yes,
anyone?
Where to start, David? Yes, hearing from folks about last night's VP debate on our Facebook page. Sin Huddleston says, I think the only thing you get from debates these days is whether the person is decent or not, and I want more substance than personality. Sin goes on to say, I don't think debates work anymore. I'd rather just see a 30-minute speech by each candidate alone on a stage. Meanwhile, echoing the chatter on social media, Andrea Pabans says, The Fly won the debate hands down. Goes on to say, even though neither really answered the questions they were asked, both were much more poised and acted like adults, Pence and Kamala Harris, that is. She adds, Pence speaking over time was tiring, but I thought Harris handled it very well and was able to get her say in. Well, folks are also getting their say in about Trump's declining that next virtual presidential debate. And also that news about potential bar reopenings in Texas. I'll be back with some of those reactions later in the program.
Yeah, have you heard about the bar reopenings, y'all? We're going to have a little bit more in just a couple of minutes, so stick around. We're coming up on 19 minutes past the hour.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at SaveNowForCollege.org.
Business and your money on the Standard. I'm David Brown. It's time to open them up, so said Governor Abbott in a Facebook message yesterday, them being bars in Texas. Twice before during this pandemic has the governor tried to reopen bars, and he has regretted it and admitted so publicly after COVID cases began to soar in the aftermath. Now he says as long as county governments give the okay, bars in those counties will be able to reopen at 50% capacity, provided customers are seated while eating or drinking.
These openings will be done in conjunction with county officials. County judges will be able to opt their county into these new openings beginning October the 14th, provided that they assist in enforcing the safe protocols.
So far, two of Texas's most populous counties, Harris and Dallas, have opted out of the governor's plan. The Texas Tribune says reviews from bar owners who've been pressuring the move are mixed. Some say they expect metro areas to opt out, and they accuse the governor of passing the buck to local officials.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Democrats have their eyes set on winning a majority in the Texas House of Representatives this fall. If they do that, it would be a huge upset in the political status quo in the state. It's been nearly 20 years since Republicans secured a complete lock on all the levers of government in Texas. This week, in a series called The Big Flip, Ashley Lopez from our home station KUT in Austin has been looking at what could happen, and she explains that even with a House majority, Democrats' main power would be to stop their Republican counterparts' proposals from becoming law.
But they would have this other power that's actually really important. It could help shape the political future of not just Texas, but the whole country. And a lot of it comes down to what year it is. So here to help me explain is KUT's Mose Bushell. Hey, Mose.
Hey, Ashley. Basically, the idea is that the party that controls the House next year, and next year in particular, could influence what parties win and lose elections for the next 10 years. Because that party will have a say in redistricting.
I'm going to stop you right here because we first got to explain what that is. So that's the word for literally redrawing the lines on political maps. It decides who represents you. Everything from city council seats to U.S. congressional districts. It happens every 10 years after the census. That's that national headcount. To make sure every district has about the same number of people. And in Texas, like most of the country, it's up to the politicians actually to redraw the maps.
Right. And basically, like, the House draws a map, the Senate draws a map, and then people kind of fight over what maps eventually the governor is going to sign off on.
Yeah, but what I understand about redistricting is that, like, a lot of it also happens not in front of microphones or in the legislature. Like, a lot of it happens behind the scenes, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in a way, these kinds of shenanigans where they're trying to put a, I don't know, like a sports stadium in their district or their kids' elementary school in their district, that gets a lot of media attention, but it's not the real serious stuff, right? Like the real right. impact of redistricting, it runs much deeper. And here, you know, we could talk about our own dear city as an example here in Austin. And so I'm going to pitch it to you because you're the political reporter, right? Describe what, you know, what is Austin's reputation politically?
I think the term is the blueberry and the tomato soup. We're like the solidly liberal democratic city in this huge Republican state.
And about how many congressional districts do we have here?
I like to say we have six. I consider six districts to be part of the Austin area.
So we have six districts, and we know that Austin's a liberal town. It's no secret. How many of those districts are represented by a Democrat?
Oh, that's easy. It's just one. Lloyd Doggett.
One district in a city with a national reputation for being a kind of Democratic stronghold. If you look at a map, I mean, it looks like a mess.
Yeah, it looks like they didn't know what they were doing.
But of course, they do. They do know what they're doing. And where they draw these maps, what they're really doing is they're picking their voters. And they have it down to a kind of science, really. I asked Stephanie Swanson about this. She's with the League of Women Voters.
So they are actually refining this whole process of drawing maps down to a surgical precision, block by block, choosing voters that they want to have in their district.
I think it might surprise people to hear it, but the Supreme Court says it's all perfectly legal. You know, draw the maps in any way you can to help yourself, to help your party.
Yeah, I should stop you right there and say that there's like a big exception to this, right? For example, like, of course you can be partisan, but it's not totally the Wild West. Like, you can't be racially discriminatory, right? That is, these lawmakers can't draw maps that disadvantage a specific racial or ethnic group.
The problem, the very, very big problem with doing that here in Texas is that race and partisanship very much go hand in hand.
So here I want to bring in someone else.
There's always been a suspicion about what increase in Latino power would do to the status quo.
This is Jose Garza, and he's a lawyer with the Mexican-American Legislative Caucus. He spent the last 40 years basically suing to get illegal maps redrawn. These suits have become basically like another part of the redistricting process. And he says most of the increase in voting power that Texas Latinos have achieved has been because of lawsuits, right? It hasn't been achieved through the traditional redistricting process.
in its simplest terms, I think that's the reason, or one of the reasons, that you haven't seen the increase in Latino power in Texas increase as much as the expectation that it would.
Okay, so we've talked about a lot of stuff, but I guess my question is, what does this mean going forward? Like, let's say the Texas House does flip. How would a divided government in Texas, that is, like, Republicans still controlling the state Senate and Democrats controlling the House, how would that change things?
So, yeah, I mean, in a few ways, right? I mean, most obviously, it would give the Democrats a seat at the table. They would be part of the negotiations around redistricting for the first time in decades.
So what does this mean for, let's say, like racial minorities that we were talking about, like Black and Hispanic representation in Texas?
So I asked Garza, I asked him about that too. And he said that, you know, divided government would help there, but he doesn't think that a flip in the House would really end, you know, racially based gerrymandering.
Well, I've been at it for too long. I've been at it for 40 years or over 40 years. When Democrats would use the same excuse when cutting up Latino and African-American neighborhoods or when packing them. And those same redistricting techniques are being used by Republicans, and they're saying they're doing it to thwart Democrats. But it's always Latinos and African-Americans that are at the heel of those moves.
And the interesting thing about what he said is that, you know, you may see true gridlock, right? It's possible that state lawmakers will be unable to produce maps. And if that happens, well, then the duty to draw these maps would go to the courts. And as Garza sees it, that's generally better for voters of color when the courts draw the maps and the politicians don't.
So it seems to me like if, let's say, Democrats take the House, no matter which path this takes, like the whole process of redistricting will look very different than it has in the past few decades.
Yes, that much we can absolutely be sure of.
That's Mose Bouchel and Ashley Lopez from our home station, KUT. You can check out the complete series on this possible future of politics in Texas wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for The Big Flip.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, sharing that regular screenings like mammograms and colonoscopies are essential preventative appointments. Early detection of cancer often leads to better outcomes. More at texasoncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The U.S. Labor Department reports today 41,656 Texans filed initial unemployment claims last week. That's 305 more than the week before. A murder arrest warrant affidavit for a white Wolf City police officer who fatally shot a 31-year-old black man was released on Wednesday. KERA's Becca Moore has details.
The affidavit from the Texas Rangers said Officer Sean Lucas was responding to a report of a possible fight in progress at a convenience store. Jonathan Price approached and offered Lucas a handshake, also asking the officer how he was doing several times. Lucas told authorities he thought Price was intoxicated and tried to detain him. After unsuccessfully trying to grab Price's arm, Lucas warned him he would use his taser if Price didn't comply. Price began to walk away, and Lucas deployed the taser, which the affidavit says wasn't, quote, fully effective. While being tased, Price appeared to grab the officer's stun gun. Lucas then fired four shots from his service weapon, striking Price in the upper torso. Price was taken to Hunt Regional Medical Center, where he died. The entire interaction was recorded on the officer's body camera, but that footage has not been released. I'm Becca Moore in Dallas.
The National Weather Service has issued a tropical storm warning for the Texas coast from Matagorda Bay to Port Arthur due to Hurricane Delta. Meteorologist Jimmy Fowler says the Category 2 storm is forecast to make landfall Friday afternoon in Louisiana, but a storm surge warning extends to the Beaumont area.
We could see some coastal flooding of 1 to 3 feet within Galveston Bay and along the barrier islands of Galveston, all the way up towards the Louisiana border.
Fowler says outer rain bands from Delta are expected to reach southeast Texas by this evening. Manatees may have been migrating to the Texas Gulf Coast as far back as the last ice age. That's according to new research from the University of Texas and Sam Houston State University. UT Austin professor Chris Bell co-authored the study that analyzed jawbone and rib fossils collected on beaches from Corpus Christi to the Louisiana border. He explains wider river outlets could have sheltered the mammals tens of thousands of years ago.
The coast could have been as much as 129 kilometers south of its modern position. And so that meant that a lot of the rivers that today flow directly into the Gulf of Mexico, at that time, they flowed together and flowed into a combined channel that went out and emptied into the Gulf as it was then.
Bell says it's unclear whether their discovery indicates manatees have been visiting the Texas coast for thousands of years or if the fossils represent an ancient resident population. I'm Joseph Leahy.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the Texas Department of Agriculture. Because of educators and school nutrition professionals, students are taught about local products and nutrition to make smarter choices about eating. More at farmfreshfriday.org.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Looking back over at the past 4 years, the current administration in Silicon Valley have not seen eye to eye, to put it mildly. The president often criticizes social media, alleging unfair bias among the companies that run those social media platforms. And many who work in tech have criticized the Trump administration's immigration policies and more. So a new analysis of campaign data by the finance watchdog group Open Secrets may or may not come as much of a surprise to you, but it does offer a quantitative peek of sorts at the politics of the relationship between high tech and the White House. Tech expert Omar Gayaga joins us once again, as he does each week here on The Standard. Omar, welcome back.
Hey, David. Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about this new analysis. You saw it in Wired magazine. Open Secrets apparently did a lot of the groundwork here. What exactly were they looking at, and what does it tell us?
Wired published this, and Open Secrets did a lot of the work examining Federal Election Commission data. And this was looking at individuals who contributed more than $200 to a campaign within the last year and a half, so since the beginning of 2019. And what they found was that employees at some of the six top tech companies, that's Alphabet, which, of course, you know, we associate with Google, Amazon, right, Apple, Facebook, Microsoft, and Oracle, contributed about close to $4.8 million to the Biden campaign and only $239,000 to the Trump campaign. So quite a bit of a difference there in the level of donations for over $200 each.
Yeah, the word lopsided comes to mind. That seems both at once kind of expected, but the fact that there seems to be such a differential in where that money is, you know, going from folks in the tech sector. Were you surprised by all of this? And is there any way of knowing how this compares with past presidential election cycles?
I'm not really surprised. It seems like there's just more activism in general, more people donating to campaigns this election cycle than the last election cycle. And in the tech industry, there's just been a lot of hot button issues that employees have gotten involved with and have protested. We've seen protests at Google and Microsoft over the company's involvement with government issues, including things like militarization of technology, as far as hiring and Black Lives Matter issues. And there is that perception that Silicon Valley is very much leans Democrat. But there, what was interesting was that definitely there is more donations going to nominees than during the 2016 election. I think it was twice as many donations made to the Biden campaign than to the Hillary Clinton campaign 4 years ago. Even Trump has raised four times more from Silicon Valley than that same period. So definitely just more donations across the board this election cycle.
More donations across the board, but I suppose it's important and worth pointing out that we're only talking about donations above that $200 mark, presumably because that's where the FEC starts keeping tally?
Right. The FEC only publishes employer data for those who contributed over $200, so this only captured about 5,300 people out of 1.4 million that work at those companies. So definitely a bit of a disparity there. So there could have been many, many, many more donations in smaller numbers than $200.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the fact that these tech companies, which have been cast as Democratic leaning, to say the least, can't actually donate directly to the campaigns themselves. We know that there are PACs which have formed to donate on their behalf. What about donations there? Are they trending similarly to employees?
Yes, absolutely. They are definitely along the same lines. And usually these PACs are formed around a company's goals. You know, if there's a particular issue that a company is trying to kind of lobby on or kind of influence Washington, yes, definitely the employees can contribute to the company PACs as opposed to donating directly to the campaign. So it's roughly about the same amount as what they contributed individually is what this data found.
You rub shoulders with a lot of folks in the tech industry, and one thing that I've seen in the news of late that kind of wouldn't seem to square with these donations is the fact that House Democrats have recently recommended breaking up a lot of these large tech companies, alleging that they create monopolies. Facebook recently even put out a paper by company lawyers saying a forced breakup from Instagram and WhatsApp would be harmful to consumers and cost billions. How do you square that?
Yeah, there's a bit of irony there that they're donating all of this money to the Democratic candidate, and yet it's House Democrats that are targeting them with this 16-month investigation into Apple, Amazon, Facebook, and Google. I mean, they released a 450-page report laying out why these companies should be kind of taken to task and parts of their business broken up to the point where Facebook had to put out a pretty lengthy response detailing why that would be harmful to that company. But I think there's bigger issues at play here than just business practices. As I mentioned before, just the protests that have happened at these companies, protests over immigration policy. So I think employees feel that they have these issues with the Trump administration that to them are bigger than the business practices of the companies they work for.
Omar Gayaga is our resident tech expert. Omar, thanks so much.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, presenting the Intersect Ed Podcast, where the stories of Texas public education policy and practice meet. Available at raiseyourhandtexas.org/podcast and most podcast platforms. Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, welcoming visitors back to the historic beach town while keeping safety in mind. Shopping, Gulf seafood, and family attractions like Moody Gardens and more. Details at Galveston.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Jared Pumphrey. I'm an author illustrator of children's picture books. I make books with my brother Jerome, and I live here in Austin, Texas. The Old Truck was our first book as both author and illustrator of the work. We have one other book that we wrote when we were teenagers that we just wrote the words for. We're originally from Houston, and Jerome was actually living in Houston at the time, and he would take road trips to come and visit me here. I was living here in Austin. It's a great road trip from Houston to Austin, and you drive past all these old farms, and he spotted these trucks.
I said, you know what I saw on the way over here? There's all these mid-century farms, and they've got these trucks out there. And like for me, the visual story came first. I was like, I could see a truck being, you know, a constant throughout a story and the world changing around that truck.
Ultimately started thinking about our own family. And, you know, going back, way back to my great-grandmother, she had a farm. She bought herself with money that she earned picking cotton. She was really all about grit and determination, perseverance. She passed that spirit down. It got all the way to us. I think that's ultimately what the book is about. It's about hard work, determination, you know, doing what it takes to make your dreams come true.
We both contributed to the words, and we both contributed to the artwork. We made more than 250 stamps to create each of the images in the book. It feels a little bit timeless or classic. You know, it feels like something I would have enjoyed reading as a kid.
It does feature characters that look like us. That was very important to us. But we didn't want to make the book about the struggle of being Black. We wanted to celebrate sort of the everyday achievements, you know, that Black people experience just like any other people. We tried to model what's in the book on what we grew up with here in Texas.
I feel like there's artwork in the book. I pass something that looks like that daily when I take my daughter to school. There's an old truck right now that if we're going into fall, the truck becomes visible because the greenery around the truck sort of dies off. So it feels very much inspired by the environment around us.
We're very happy with how well the old truck has been received. Shortly after this book came out, we began work on the follow-up to this book called The Old Boat. In a lot of ways, you know, it's also based on our experiences in our family. Our grandmother used to take us fishing in Galveston. And so we're pretty excited about it. It comes out in March.
What's cool is that The Old Truck came out, and then we did see it being received so well. And we're like, oh, great, I think The Old Boat is going to be a perfect fit. I'm Jerome Pumphrey. I'm a writer and illustrator. I wrote The Old Truck with my brother Jarrett, and you're listening to The Texas Standard.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Many of Texas's biggest cities wrestle with what to do about large populations of stray animals. And in Dallas, nearly three-quarters of the 40,000 dogs and cats that end up in the animal shelter appear to come from one place. As KERA's Stella Chavez reports, animal advocates say there's a staggering need for more pet resources and education in the city's southern half.
Stephanie Kunkel-Timko spent more than 2 years feeding and rescuing dogs in a South Dallas neighborhood known as Mill City. Things were bad.
And we got her some food underneath there. She's nursing.
One time, she found a dog and her puppies underneath a van. The mama dog was chained to a log, and the log had gotten stuck against the tires, so she'd given birth there.
She can't even stand up, and she can't get out from underneath this van. Her owner has prostate cancer.
Timko says the dog's owner had gotten sick and couldn't afford to care for his pet. Timko and other volunteers eventually rescued mom and puppies and found them a home.
We helped a lot of people in Mill City. We did more than 70 spay-neuter surgeries, vaccinations, microchips, but we also managed a lot of emergency vet visits and bills.
The result? A dramatic drop in loose dogs, sick dogs, and mistreated dogs.
What we're really talking about here are pets in poverty. And it's a Dallas problem, but it's a national problem.
Timko and others have lobbied to fund pet care and education in underserved neighborhoods. There are organizations like SPCA of Texas and Spay Neuter Network that offer clinics for basic preventative pet care. But money for free and low-cost clinics often runs out. And when that happens, there aren't many options for pet owners in South Dallas.
The need is staggering. And the resources that exist are sparse and either impossible to access due to transportation or utterly unaffordable.
Ed Jamison, director of Dallas Animal Services, agrees there's a problem. South Dallas is short on grocery stores, so it's known for being a food desert. But Jamison says it's also a pet care desert.
When you Google pet stores in Dallas, you see a huge divide at Interstate 30. There's like one south of Interstate 30. You do vet clinics south of Interstate 30, and you've got the SPCA's clinic and one other clinic. That's it for the entire southern sector of Dallas.
KERA aired a recent story about a Dallas woman jailed and then placed in an immigration detention center after surrendering her sick dog to the city shelter. It sparked conversations about helping pet owners in need. Maria Flores was eventually released from Bluebonnet Detention Center, and a grand jury decided not to prosecute her for animal cruelty. But she still faces possible deportation. If Flores had known that help for her dog was available, Jamison says things may have gone differently.
We don't want people to be scared of calling city services. We don't ask people their status. You know, we have to have some type of legal ID to do the transaction at the counter. But the last thing we want is to not be seen as that resource and not to be seen as a trusted resource.
In May, Dallas Animal Services launched a new service for pet owners. Now, when someone calls 311 wanting to surrender a pet, the call gets routed to an intervention center run by Spay Neuter Network. And the city shelter is also part of a pilot program with other animal shelters around the country, designed to help families who are struggling to care for their pets.
Our main goal is trying to find ways to keep pets with their people in these difficult times. And we need to not let situations escalate this bad and to contact us as soon as there starts to be a question.
Timko, who points to the work she and others did in South Dallas, says outreach is key. That means going door to door, getting to know residents, and providing information in both English and Spanish. She's also proposed adding animal resource centers in certain South Dallas zip codes, but that idea hasn't gained traction.
If you can't get grant funding for this stuff, it really stifles innovation to move animal welfare forward. Being out there helping pets in poverty, helping owners keep their pets. But we're not going to get there unless we have funding for it.
Until then, animal advocates will have to approach this problem one pet at a time. I'm Stella Chavez in Dallas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where faculty do research for the greater good. Like biology professor Dean Williams, who uses genetic mapping to help save horned lizards from extinction. More at tcu.edu/conservation. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Houston's Hurricane Harvey housing recovery program is changing hands. The Texas General Land Office just got the okay from the feds to take over the relief program. Joining us now is Jasper Scherer. He covers City Hall and politics for the Houston Chronicle. Jasper, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me on.
First, let's set the scene here. There's been this ongoing legal battle with the GLO's attempt to take on this Harvey recovery program. Why does the General Land Office want to take this over? What's the legal backstory here?
So the backstory is this ongoing battle over $1.3 billion in federal recovery money that's been set aside for the city of Houston to essentially complete as many home repairs as possible for folks impacted by Harvey. So these can be, you know, completely tearing down homes and rebuilding them altogether, reimbursing homeowners for repairs they complete on their own. What the General Land Office is saying is that the city simply hasn't completed those repairs fast enough and that they would be better suited to run the program themselves. From the city side, those delays are essentially the fault of the state, who is required to sign off on all this repair work. So all of this has culminated in a lawsuit that's still ongoing in the Texas Supreme Court, where the city is trying to stop this takeover from happening. But for now, it appears to be going on track, and the GLO is set to take over control of the money.
Other than just being critical of how Houston is handling this, are there politics involved? Because I know you have a mayor who is a Democrat, the head of the GLO, George P. Bush, a Republican. Are there politics involved here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's hard to say how much of it boils down to the kind of partisan Democrat-Republican side of things. Mm-hmm. But what we do know is that since the beginning of this process, the GLO did signal at least some interest in administering the program themselves, and they actually have taken over control in a more, I would say, amicable fashion of the county's sort of parallel programs. The county judge in Harris County, Lena Hidalgo, is a Democrat, and the administration, you know, it's generally controlled by Democrats. So I think the politics maybe more at play here are just a sort of long-running feud between George P. Bush and Mayor Turner, as opposed to just kind of a Democrat-Republican traditional feud.
Is there a practical difference between the way, say, the GLO would handle that pile of money versus Houston?
Yeah, so the city's program prioritizes low-income, disabled, and senior residents primarily, and that seems to be what is driving their attempts to retain control of the program, in the sense that the General Land Office, while they still follow federal guidelines
right.
that require certain amounts of money to go to low-income folks, the analysis that we've conducted shows that Houston's program does send a bit more of their funds to folks at the lowest ends of the income brackets. So that would be the most kind of striking difference between the two programs.
But beyond the sort of politics, the behind-the-scenes wrangling and all of this,
What is the significance on the ground for a move like this? Because there are still people who are suffering with the need to recover, people who have not been able to return their homes because there are still repairs that need to be made, that sort of thing. What does this mean for the recovery effort?
Right. Yeah, I think that's probably the most important question here. And really what we know so far is fairly limited. And as recently as Tuesday afternoon, Mayor Turner still had yet to see certain details that would basically allow him to know what effect this would have on Houston residents. But talking to the General Land Office, they did tell us that any applicants, you know, residents who are have existing projects. So if their home is, you know, somewhere along the pipeline, be it under construction or if they have just submitted an application, as long as the city sends over the necessary paperwork to the state, those projects would be able to be picked up where they were. So they would not have to start over. And just some important context on that point, the state has given the city until November 6th to wrap up its recovery program. So that would be, it's essentially a 30-day sort of notice to wrap things up.
Jasper Shearer continues to follow this developing story. He covers City Hall and politics for the Houston Chronicle. Jasper, thanks for speaking with us on The Standard.
Appreciate you having me on.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Social media editor Wells Dunbar is following what Texans are talking about on this Thursday. Hello again, Wells.
Hello, David. Well, as we've been hearing about in the show, this new edict from the governor regarding bars in Texas that they may open at 50% capacity should the county judge approve definitely has folks talking, hearing a lot of comments coming in on our Facebook and on our Twitter pages via Twitter. Petty LaBelle says, nobody wants to shut bars down forever, but adds, drunk people do not socially distance, putting staff and customers at risks. She says that the bar industry needs to come up with good creative solutions, otherwise many businesses will be closing forever. And some of those sentiments are echoed by another Twitter user, Tommy De La Torre. He says that some bars and nightclubs are already open here in Dallas. I actually went to one this past weekend, and it was a hot mess. He says that at the beginning, everything was fine, everyone was social distancing, but once people had a couple of drinks, it seems like they forgot about their masks. And on the ground in El Paso, John Davis notes that he was reading today that El Paso just had 523 new COVID cases. No bars or restaurants for me, he adds. Another listener raising an interesting point, too, as well, regarding that decision that lies with the county judge, David, noting that maybe such a rule would be okay if no one leaves their county, but obviously inter-county travel not going to be restricted here with the governor's order. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens, especially here as flu season could potentially get underway shortly. So whether or not this order will stand, I guess, remains to be seen, David.
A lot of other news happening out there. I was reading the Texas Tribune, and an appeals court is saying that the census count has to continue through the end of the month. I don't know if you've heard about that. And also, there's some news on the unemployment front. Apparently, the Texas Tribune is reporting that the fallout from the coronavirus outbreak has some 3.6 million Texans filing for unemployment relief since the beginning of the crisis in mid-March, and that the unemployment rate, which comes out on Thursdays, remains nearly double what it was pre-pandemic. So some news happening on this Thursday. What else are you seeing?
Interesting headline here in the Dallas Morning News. We women of the Texas House want a fair shot at leadership positions in the next legislature. You know, obviously there's been a lot of discussion about what that next session of the legislature will look like exactly, what with COVID, social distancing, and the like. But sort of picking up another national reckoning that's been underway, this discussion, you know, the sort of the Me Too discussion and discussion of women's equality issues, looks like it's co-authored by Representative Donna Howard and Ina Menares. So definitely an interesting article that we'll share on the Texas Standard Twitter account right there.
We're out of time for the big broadcast. The news continues over at texasstandard.org. And of course, we'll be right back here tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the crew, wishing you a terrific Thursday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.